Everybody's doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe it's 2022 and we're still like, are you okay? I mean, it's been, I mean, besides the physical things, we've got the mental things. I mean, a lot of people are not very mentally well right now either because of all that. Anyway,
There's just been a lot of stuff going on at the post office, so I don't know how to deal with it. We've been on the end of another 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow. Wow. Crazy. Well, it's eight. What is it? It's the 16th of January, and we are in Isaiah 30. And we started the first section last time, but it's quite a long chapter, like 3, 4, 5 pages long, this chapter. So there was a almost set of like final decrees or something like that, but it was pretty serious. Therefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel was said a few times, and it was about sort of a similar thing to what we've been dealing with before, which is about not having faith. And it was fascinating last week because it carried over into the message so well. And it's about relying on earthly things. And in the case of this case, they were relying on Egypt, and they had sent ambassadors to try to get help from Egypt. And God is saying, why are you guys looking for help from Egypt? And they call it the shadow of Egypt, and the threat is coming. But, and we pick up in 30:18, but, okay, therefore the Lord will wait that he may be gracious to you. So even with all of that, the message is, even when you're messing up, even when you're doing all these things you're not supposed to be doing and not doing the right thing, the Lord will wait so that he can be gracious to you. So he won't judge you right away. He won't do anything to you right away. He will wait and be gracious to you. And therefore, he will be exalted that he may have mercy on you. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for him. So during this time of turmoil, when things are going wrong for these people, and a lot of them are turning to the wrong thing to try to help them or fleeing. The people that wait on the Lord are going to be saved. They're going to be blessed. So, this is, I wouldn't necessarily call it a test because whenever you say, oh, there's a test going on, it's kind of like gives people a weird feeling. But basically, imagine that you're in Jerusalem and that the Assyrian army is coming and everybody's doing something. Some people are fleeing, some people are going to Egypt for help, whatever they're doing. Some people are preparing for battle. Some people are praying and waiting on the Lord, and the Lord is saying, I got you. And some people are turning to him and going, okay, well, let's see it. Show us your glory. Let's see what you got, because we trust in you and believe in you, and we're just going to stay put and believe in you. And he's saying those are the people that are going to be in the best shape, because they're going to see, they're going to be watching and waiting, and they're going to see exactly what I'm going to do. So, for the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem, you shall weep no more. He will be very gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. But your eyes shall see your teachers. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Whenever you turn to the right hand, and whenever you turn to the left, you will also defile the covering of your images of silver and the ornament of your molded images of gold. You will throw them away as an unclean thing. You will say to them, get away. So this is the purification process. As we know from previous messages, the people have been doing really well in Jerusalem for a long time. And They've began making lots of deals, business deals, arrangements, partnerships with all kinds of people from all kinds of cultures. And over time, those cultural ideas have been seeping in. So what this is describing is an area of purification, where instead of, you know, putting them in the corner. So in other words, instead of not listening to or pushing aside the teachers of God and listening to everything else, you're pulling them out of the corner. You're pulling them out of the being pushed aside and trying listening. And your eyes are on your teachers and you're trying to hear what they have to say. And they're saying, this is the way, walk in it. And wherever you look, you see these images with silver and gold and all these idols and all these problems. It's like you didn't see them before, but your eyes are getting opened. So what I think is going on in Jerusalem, like I said, 2,700 years removed, we can't know for sure, but what I think is going on in Jerusalem is that there's a remnant fighting the good fight. There's a remnant going, I know this is happening, I know this is bad, but trust in the Lord. And they're getting rid of idols, and they're purifying themselves, and they're praying, and they're saying, okay, Lord, here we are. And as we're moving toward the slightly later chapters, when it starts to happen, this is sort of the preparation. So some of the people are doing that, and they're going to do it more as it gets more dangerous. And then, of course, afterwards is different, because afterwards, you know, right? Once the Lord does it, you know. So it's like the difference of the Christians right before the rapture and right after. The Christians after the rapture believe in God and give up everything and surrender completely to God, but they have a really good reason. The guys right before the rapture didn't have that good of a reason. They didn't have some giant earth-wide thing. Of course, sometimes they get a giant earth-wide thing as a hint. You know, how are you going to deal with, and like the pandemic's a perfect example. How are you going to deal with this? And one of the ways to deal with this is to maintain hope and to provide hope to others and to try to be uplifting and to try not to turn to, you know, just being hypnotized by the news all the time and, you know, try not to be overtaken by spirits of doubt and fear and everything else. It's a similar situation. I mean, it's not the same, obviously, but it's a similar situation. And if you're pushing away these idols, which is, this is such a great passage for where we're at. We're supposed to be in this 21-day fasting thing, right? Which means I'm really looking forward to lunch. Okay, because I'm doing like every other day, you know, not eating. And it's usually, sometimes it's easy, but usually it's like, oh my God. Oh my goodness. Anyway, so yesterday was my no eating day, and today it's like, I'm about to embarrass myself. So, anyway, I don't know how that works. But anyway, you know, people are putting away idols. And this is a great thing because a lot of people are fasting technology or whatever they're fasting, right? Anger or, you know, conflict, whatever. Whatever they're fasting. And that's a good symbol here is putting away, you know, telling those idols, get away. So you know, and everybody's different and everything's different. Everybody's distractions are different. But the idea of, you know, trying to get closer to God and trying to get the idols away is what we're doing here. Then he will give you the rain for your seed with which you shall sow the ground and bread of the increase of the earth. It will be fat and plentiful. And that day your cattle will feed in large pastures. Likewise, the oxen and the young donkeys that work the ground will eat cured fodder, which has been winnowing with the shovel and fan. There will be on every high mountain, on every high hill, rivers and streams of water in the day of the great slaughter when the towers fall. Moreover, the light of the moon will be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun will be sevenfold, as in the light of 7 days, in the day that the Lord binds up the bruise of his people and heals the stroke of their wound. Now, obviously, we've shifted into more poetic language. So we've got a couple ways to read this. And the first way is realistically. If the sun really is super bright and the moon really is super bright and everything is like this physically, then this is probably the end times we're talking about, right? Or it could be symbolic language of how great it's going to be when, you know, after the enemy is defeated in the present time, you know, the parties that will ensue when everybody realizes that they're saved. When they get saved this time, it's not going to be like a possible reversal. Like the 185,000 Assyrian soldiers aren't going to go away, because then they could come back. They're going to die, which means they can't come back, which means you're really free, right? And so, you know, it's kind of like when you leave Egypt and you're doing great, but then they're chasing you and you see the army chasing you and you're like, they're going to trap us up against this river and they're going to take us back. You're happy because you're free, but you're also in doubt. And of course, their mindset was different anyway, because they had, you know, lived their whole lives as slaves. But this is not going to be that mindset. This is going to be the mindset of complete freedom. The battle is over. So I do find a couple things interesting. Cured fodder has been winnowed with the shovel and the fan. This was how my grandpa convinced me that the malted barley was for the cattle. Because malting. So what you're doing is you're getting the grain to sprout. And sprouted grain is really healthy. It has a lot of really great properties to it. And so you get your sprouted grain breads and stuff. And they've talked a lot about that. And some people think that the special breads that they had in things like Daniel and stuff were malted grains. But the winnowing. Anyway, you've got every hill and every high mountain with rivers and streams of water. If a new stream of water is a good sign, then I'm being heavily blessed right now. So that's, I have a brand new little creek. I was standing there yesterday just looking at it like, how can this be flowing like this right out of the ground? It's really weird, you guys. It's like dirt and then there's a creek. And there's nowhere it's coming from. And you're staring at it like, it's so strange. And it's running. Like, it's a little creek. It's like about, you know, a few inches wide. It's a little creek. And you're just like, how is this even possible? You're starting to dig the well and everything. We're going to have our little spring house soon. But this is, you just stare at it like, how is this even possible? And I was joking with some guys. I was like, I didn't even hit anything with the staff. but it was very much like that. It's very much like that. It's like totally crazy. And I think it's a natural phenomenon, you know, because I'm not Israelites in the desert. But it's kind of a demonstration of what that looked like. Like suddenly there's water coming out of the ground. There's a stream of water just coming forth from nowhere. It's just mind-boggling. Anyway, so... So in other words, this is all good news. I think this is a combination, like before, where we're talking about what happens after the Assyrians are defeated, but also what happens at the end times when there is a wonderful, you know, time of absolute increase and peace and wonder. It would have been a really good time right after that. And unfortunately, what they needed to do was a permanent adjustment, but they didn't, and so it's going to continue. But behold, the name of the Lord comes from afar. Now we're on 27. Behold, the name of the Lord comes from afar, burning with his anger. Now this is not about them, because they're partying, they're having a great time, right? They're being blessed. So we got to figure out what this is about. Behold, the name of the Lord comes from afar, burning with his anger, and his burden is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, and his tongue is like a devouring fire. His breath is like an overflowing stream, which reaches up to the neck. to sift the nations with the sieve of futility, and there shall be a bridle in the jaws of the people, causing them to err. Now, what the heck is going on? Because we just had this big party where there was like a really bright sun, a really bright moon, and all the binding up the bruises and heals their wounds, and everything was wonderful. What is this talking about? We have to try to figure out if there's any clues in the text. Okay. So, comes from afar is interesting because we have in Jerusalem, but this says that the name of the Lord comes from afar, burning with anger, with a heavy burden. And it says sifting the nations with the sieve of futility. So this is something different. Let's continue in 29. You shall have a song as in the night when a holy festival is kept, and gladness of heart is when one goes with a flute to come into the mountain of the Lord, to the mighty one of Israel. The Lord will cause his glorious voice to be heard and show the descent of his arm and the indignation of his anger. So what we've got is this two things happening. We've got this great sort of anger and wrath, but we've got this party going on of all this awesome increase and, you know, healing. And we got to look at the flow of what's happened. So there's a rebellious people section where people are turning the wrong direction. Then there's the people that didn't turn the wrong direction. Then there's the enemy coming, and the enemy's being destroyed. And while the enemy's being destroyed, the people that are in the mountain of the Lord will hear his glorious voice, and the descent of his arm with the indignation of his anger and the flame of a devouring fire with scattering tempests and hailstones. Now, this could be poetic language, or it could be symbolic, right? Or it could be real. So we're trying to figure it out. Who is he talking about? What's going on? And through the voice of the Lord, Assyria will be beaten down. Okay, we get an answer in 31. Through the voice of the Lord, Assyria will be beaten down as he strikes with the rod, and in every place where the staff of punishment passes, which the Lord lays on him, it will be with tambourines and harps, and in battles of brandishing he will fight with it. For Tophet was established of old. So Tophet is located south of Jerusalem. It's a place where the valleys of Hinnom and Kidron meet. It's a deep, wide pit containing a bonfire of blazing wood, where children had at times been burned to death as offering to pagan deities. Okay, just so you know what Tophet is. For Tophet was established of old. Yes, for the king it was prepared. He has made it deep and large. It's a pyre. Its pyre is fire and much wood. The breath of the Lord, like a stream of brimstone, kindles it. Okay. That's a whole lot. And it's a whole lot of poetic language, and it's a whole lot of crazy words and scary language. But what it is, if you take it all in all and put it all together, is a positive message. Because it's not the people in Jerusalem, it's not the people that turned to God and put away their ornaments and their idols and focused and listened to the teachers telling them, the main one of which is Isaiah. Okay? It's not that they're going to be tortured and rained upon with fire and hell and all these bad things can happen. But it's the enemy. It's Assyria. So Isaiah is telling them, and he probably should have said it a little more straightforward. Like, hey, Assyria's coming, but God's going to take care of it. Instead of, remember that pit of fire, you know, a little poetic Isaiah.
Okay.
So he's a super creative guy. But anyway, but they might have been singing it. I don't know. They might have been singing a song of it. He might have been giving it as a speech. I don't know. When you give a poetic, when you give a big speech at a really important time, poetic language is used, you know. It's like, I had a dream. You know, one day, you know, little black boys and little white boys will be playing together, right? Or, you know, this is a very poetic, very important speech. Or, The reason we choose to go to the moon and all these other things is not because they're easy, but because they're hard, right? And these speeches are really big deals. They're 47 years ago, right? You get poetic language. You get this real flowery, gigantic speech because it's something so important that's monumental. So what he's saying is, in that same way as those three examples, he's saying, listen, the enemy's coming. The ones who turn away from their idols, the ones who don't go run to Egypt, the ones who don't do anything stupid, who just rely on God, are going to see a great, wonderful thing happen. And God's coming. And he's coming to take care of this problem. And it's not going to be pretty. Because we're talking about a giant imperial army. I mean, you're talking about, if you're talking about a couple hundred thousand people, you're talking about an army that's one of the greatest armies in the world, right? It's one of the biggest, craziest things in the world. We don't know the exact numbers. Like, say, when the Persians, Pastor Todd was talking about Thermopylae last time, and I've mentioned Thermopylae quite a few times over the years, just where the Persians were trying to get to Greece. They were trying to attack Europe. If they would have gone into Greece and sacked Athens and destroyed it at this point in time in history, then we would have lost the seeds of democracy and may not have had the same history of the world. And 300 Spartans, which were just totally crazy, as well as a bunch of other random like goat herders and stuff, defended this pass called the Hot Gates, which is where all this stuff kind of went together with these mountains. You had to go through this little pass to get in there and do what you wanted to do. And because it was a bottleneck, he was able to defend it, and they fought till the last man died, but they defended it so well and bought so much time that the rest of Greece rose up, and the rest of the Spartans and the rest of the Athenians and the rest of everybody rose up. And then the Battle of Marathon happened, and you guys probably know about Marathon because you probably know the exact distance it was from the center of Athens, because the reason we have marathons is because the guy ran 26.1 miles or whatever it is from Marathon battlefield to Athens, told everybody the thing, and then dropped dead. So don't run a marathon is the message of that, I guess, unless you train a long time. Don't just like break out and start running for 26 miles. Anyway. But that's why they call it a marathon. But anyway, they were defeated, and then later they were permanently defeated by the northern Greek area called Macedonia through Alexander. But the whole point of telling that story was that they had, you know, this certain group of people, you know, who cared enough to try to do this, and even though it seemed like a small number, it was enough to overwhelm this giant army. They don't know exactly how big this giant army was. The best guess, and I think Pastor Todd gave the best guess, which is around 300,000, but it was a lot, like a lot. In some of the annals, they say 1 million. That's unlikely, possible, but unlikely, a little too big. It definitely wasn't like 20,000 guys. It was like hundreds of thousands of guys. This same type of thing, you know, because we're talking about several hundred years earlier here, this same type of thing has happened with the Assyrians, where they're bringing like 200,000 people to Jerusalem. And that, I mean, that is just an outrageously giant army. And, I mean, I don't know the numbers of, like, say, D-Day, but it's a lot of people involved. But some of these armies, I mean, these hundreds of thousands of people, is what's about to come. And that's why this is such a large speech with such giant language in it. Because they're saying, there's going to be some of you guys who are going to be patiently watching. But here's what it's going to be like. And then they use as an example that the people would understand, which is Tophet or Tophet, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but I think it's Tophet, which was this giant pit where they would build these giant blazing fires and throw people in it, pagan worship, where they would sacrifice kids in this big burning pit. And of course, that's horrifying. That entire concept is horrifying. But the point of it is, that's what this is going to be like. It's going to be like the Syrian army is going to be like kids getting thrown into this pit. This is going to be a thing where you're going to see something, you know, crazy. And this time, that fire is the breath of the Lord. So in the end of 33, it says, the pyre is fire with much wood. The breath of the Lord, like a stream of brimstone, kindles it. So this is like an image of like a valley. And then in the valley is full of wood. And then God goes and lights it all on fire, right? Now, that's just the symbol of what's going to happen to the Assyrian army. Pretty powerful symbol, and it utilizes something they would have understood at the time. For me, it's fascinating. We don't know how the angel kills them. I'm assuming they don't all burn because people would have woken up. But I don't know. Maybe they burn. It's interesting to me that we misinterpret fire a lot. Fire gets used by God a lot. And we always think about fire like the burning pit of hell and like devil, the devil is related to fire. So we always think of the devil as a fiery creature that, you know, can, you know, breathe fire or shoot fire out of his eyes or hands or whatever it is. And that's not it at all. The pit is him burning. So we're, you know, just like people used to say, hey, I want to go to hell because it'll be where the party is or the cool people are, right? They missed the point entirely. And we do the same thing with fire. We miss the point. Fire is not, hell is not the devil's domain where he's happy and he's the ruler of hell and he gets to do all these cool things with all his fire. That's not the story. The story is he's burning. He's in torment. Everyone with him is in torment. There's no time to have a party. There's no time, you know, there's no discussion of, oh, wow, I really love this fiery place. It is horrific. The fire is God. And we hear over and over again about how in the end times, you know, the first time he wiped the slate, he didn't really destroy too much. It was a flood. So it flooded everything, but everything was still kind of there. It was just flooded. Everyone was killed. The next time is fire. And fire will destroy everything. And this is also referring to that. So Isaiah tends to be speaking in the immediate future as well as the distant future. So you can call Assyria not only the Assyria that's coming to attack Jerusalem right now, but you can call Assyria the great kingdoms and empires of the world, you know. And what's going to happen to the great kingdoms and empires of the world is they're all going to be burned up. And the flames of devouring fires with scattering tempests and hailstones. And Assyria is being beaten down, but also, and then they throw in with the tambourines and harps. It's so crazy. Because the people of the Lord are going to be celebrating, and their celebration is worshiping the Lord. So they're going to see whatever it is and realize that the Lord is showing his glory and that there's victory. And they're going to, you know, be playing tambourines and harps. And in the battle, they're going to, you know, and this relates to Gideon. It relates to Joshua. A lot of times in the Bible, there's stories of battles where the people are instructed to just worship the Lord. Just pray, just sing, march around, and the walls are going to fall down or the enemy is going to be destroyed. And God will do that as an example. And he does it quite a few times in the Bible. He's about to do it again. So as we move into 31, you see that it says, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, So this is the same story that we're in from 30 and 31, and it's continuing, and it's saying, woe to those people that are going down to Egypt to get help, and because they rely on horses, they trust chariots, and they're not looking to the Holy One of Israel. So you know, this is the same sort of almost like a summary. Look at this. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but who do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord. Exclamation point, right? Exclamation point. Yet he also is wise and will bring disaster, and will not call back his words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers, and against the help of those who work iniquity. Now the Egyptians are men, and not God, and the horses are flesh, and not spirit. When the Lord stretches out his hand, both he who helps will fall, and he who is helped will fall. They all will perish together. So in other words, and I don't know historically, I'll probably look this up before the next class, but I wonder if the guys who went down to Egypt managed to get a group to come back, and if they were just met by the Assyrians and slaughtered, which is pretty much what would happen. The Egyptians are not in a position at this point to fight Assyria. And Assyria has conquered Babylonians at this point. Babylon's about to make a comeback. But the Assyrians are running everything, which means that they have all the armies of all those areas. So it would be a pretty bad idea to try to bring another army against them. I mean, I understand what they're thinking. They're thinking, let's get Egypt. We've got the army of Israel, right? We've got the army of Judah. And it's not very big enough, but we got an army. They've got their chariots and all their stuff, which has been around forever in Egypt. Let's just get them up here. The two of us together can fight this battle. But the problem is, that's exactly what the northern tribe just did. They went to a nearby giant, powerful kingdom called Aram Damascus and allied with them in an attempt to fight. First, they were going to attack the south, and then they were trying to fight off the Assyrians, and they've been completely destroyed. So they also got a lesson of what happens when you do that. That doesn't work. But they're just not paying attention. And what this says is that they're going to fall. The people who are helping and the people who went to get help are both going to fall. Only the people that are going to live are the ones that are sitting inside of the walls of Jerusalem praying. That's the only people that are going to live. For thus the Lord has spoken to me. So this is 31:4. For thus the Lord has spoken to me. As a lion roars, and a young lion over his prey, when a multitude of shepherds is summoned against him, he will not be afraid of their voice, not to be disturbed by their noise. So the Lord of hosts will come down to fight for Mount Zion and for its hill, like birds flying about. So will the Lord of hosts defend Jerusalem. Defending, he will also deliver it. Passing over, he will preserve it. So this is the imagery. The reason they say a young lion is because a young lion hasn't learned the danger of shepherds yet, right? A lion is not scared of shepherds. They learn that there's a bunch of shepherds and that humans are really dangerous, and they stay away because they'll hit you in the head with a rock from a sling or whatever, or hit you with a stick or a spear. They learn their lesson, but a young lion doesn't know the lesson. So when the shepherds are making their noise trying to scare him away, he doesn't care. He's growling and making his noise. And that's like how God will react to this army. You know, even though this army's making noise and it seems to be a threat, he's going to ignore this threat. He's going to come. And here's the interesting thing, like birds flying about. So in other words, a whole bunch of birds just flying everywhere. So you can't really see them. Have you ever noticed that? Like if there's a giant bunch of blackbirds or whatever, and they all go, blah, blah, blah. You look at sections, you see it, but there's so many birds and so much stuff going on, it's like really hard to comprehend. And birds blow my mind sometimes because sometimes they move in patterns and there's just like thousands of them. It's really weird. And then sometimes they're just everywhere. And you don't really know where the birds are. Like, we know there's birds, but we can't see them, but they're all over the place. It's like all these birds flying around. It's how God's going to deal with this enemy army, which is a symbol of like they have no idea. They can't even tell it's the enemy. They don't know what's going on. Return to him. So this is 6, 31, 6. Return to him against whom the children of Israel have deeply revolted. For in that day every man shall throw away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, sin, which your own hands have made for yourselves. In that day everybody will throw it away. And then Assyria shall fall by a sword not of man, and a sword not of mankind shall devour him. But he shall flee from the sword, and his young men shall become forced labor. He shall cross over to his stronghold for fear, and his princes shall be afraid of the banner, says the Lord, whose fire is in Zion and whose furnace is in Jerusalem. I love the last part of that. So, his fire is in Zion, his furnace is in Jerusalem. So, in other words, it's all the Lord. So, on the other side, the Assyrian army marching toward Jerusalem should see a giant fire on top of this mountain, but they don't because it's the fire of the Lord. This is a spiritual battle as much as it is a physical battle, just like we talk about all the time, where the enemy is the one running this, where crushing Jerusalem and crushing the people of God is the mission, but that's not how it works. So the fire imagery continues, and basically we have God setting up shop. The people are throwing away all their idols. The people are worshiping. Everybody's returned to him. So he's setting up shop. It's a furnace. It's a fire. And the reason it's a furnace is, how does a furnace work? You stoke the fire, you put things into the fire, you stoke the fire, you make the furnace gets bigger and hotter. You keep throwing wood into the wood burning oven's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And that's what's happening. So it's the worship. Just like we've been talking about in Sunday, sermons. The worship is the fuel. So the people turning to God and worshiping and throwing away their idols and focusing on him is stoking the fire. And it'll get hot enough that it's going to burn the enemy up. And this is a pretty big deal because we're talking about a giant enemy army and all of that. But for us, it's an image that we should remember in our lives. Let's say that we have enemies attacking us. Let's say that we have problems coming our way. They could be anything from a simple problem with a friend or a kid or something like that, all the way to the biggest problem we could possibly have that threatens our lives, all the way to the whole country going sideways. It could be anything. Nothing is too big for the Lord. In fact, everything is really tiny compared to the Lord. So there's nothing that can, I mean, the whole entire world being in turmoil is not a big deal to the Lord. So the more you turn, it's like your prayer is fuel. So, let's say you're hungry and you're trying to cook some soup, right? And you need the soup to survive. You've got to make a fire to cook the soup. And so if you try to do it yourself, you're struggling because you're now out there trying to get wet pieces of wood and trying to strike stuff together, right? But if you're dealing with God, you just turn a button and there's a big fire. And you don't have to put a lot into it, but the more you put into it, the bigger and more powerful this fire gets. So the imagery is our worship, our prayer, our turning away from idols, our focusing, which is why we do this whole fasting thing at Radiant multiple times a year. I feel like we just did it. It could have been a year ago. I don't know. But they're talking about sometimes you keep going, and I think I kind of kept going, but I don't remember when it was. But the point is, we do that because the idea is not just to not eat or whatever. It's not that simple. The idea is to focus on God and get rid of whatever's getting in your way. and the time that you could be spent doing whatever, whether it's video games or eating or whatever it is, you're spending in prayer, you're spending in focusing on God. Because this message here in Isaiah 30 and 31 is that the way they're going to be saved is to turn to the Lord. And the prayer is going to be fuel to the fire, and God has set up a furnace, and he's going to burn the enemy up. And the sword that's going to strike them down, this is what 8:8 says. Assyria shall fall by the sword, but a sword not of man. A sword not of mankind shall devour him. So the sword, the fire, the birds, those are all images. But something is going to strike down this army, and it's not going to be people. And the people that are with God are going to see it, and they're going to know. So as we continue next week, we get into, you know, longer discussions of the same idea of the prayer and everything. But when we get, you know, we're in 33 next week. As we get to 33, 34, he's talking about judgment. And then it's 36 where this finally starts, the actual historical chapter, 36, 37, where we're getting, instead of the poetic prophecies of what's going to happen, we get the actual historical account of what happens. And look at what it looks like. I'm just going to show you this. That's the Assyrian Empire, and there's a little hole in it. That little hole is Jerusalem. The whole thing, you notice the Assyrian Empire is Egypt. So they're going to conquer Egypt. They conquer Babylon. They conquer Egypt, they conquer Tarsus, they conquer all the areas of sort of northern part of the Middle East into Turkey. They conquer all of the Holy Land, all of Sinai, all the way down into Egypt, all the way to Ethiopia. So everything that we've been talking about, where all the people around you seem to be so powerful, they've all been hurting the people of God or helping or threatening or whatever they've been doing over the years. All these people, all of them, are about to be taken out by the Assyrians. The only little spot is going to be Jerusalem. And that is mind-boggling. It should be mind-boggling to historians and archaeologists. It is to some of them. A lot of them have been confused by all their college experiences into not understanding the historicity of the Bible. And that's a common flaw. I mean, people that study things in big universities don't necessarily know that how big a deal the Bible is. But when we go to the archaeological evidence and we actually research it, we're shocked to discover that something crazy does happen. In the actual stele of Sennacherib, who's the emperor that's coming, in his actual records, which have nothing to do with the people of God and nothing to do with Judaism or Christianity, there's a list of all the things he conquers and all the cool stuff that happens in his campaign. And there's a hiccup around Jerusalem. And he doesn't go into detail. And for me, the best part of that is the missing piece of information. Because he's bragging about all his victories, and he said, "We got to Jerusalem, and then they came home." That's basically what it says. We got to Jerusalem, and then we came home. And he doesn't say, "Oh, an angel of the Lord." I mean, the emperor of the pagan empire is not going to write on a stone, and an angel of God killed us all. That's not going to be his bragging point, right? But it's fascinating how these things kind of overlap, both in time frame. And, you know, when you do your archaeology, they all kind of match. But also the fact that it appears to be in other cultural references as well, this bizarre thing that happened. Because you got to admit, that's pretty bizarre. If this giant army of 200,000 comes marching in, they take over everything everywhere, and they go to this one city, they're going to finish off Jerusalem because they finished off everything, you know. And then one night they just all die. I mean, And we have no idea how God kills this army. Maybe it is an angel with a sword moving really fast. Maybe it's a disease. Maybe he uses a disease. Maybe he uses comets. Maybe the fires get out of control. We don't know. But they all die and then they go away. And so this, all this setup has been leading to that, with Isaiah saying, here's how this victory is going to happen. You're going to give up your idols. You're going to pray. Everybody's going to turn to God, and it's going to be okay. And some people listen, most importantly, the king. And it does. It does work like that. So that's sort of what we're building into. But it also includes the history, the past, and the future. And it's a lesson for all time. This is how you should deal with all adversity for all time. Turning away from idols, turning toward the Lord. This should be how everyone should deal with adversity all the time. So luckily, we don't have any adversity in our lives, so we don't have to worry about it. I'm just kidding. All right, let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for this day and this time to come together. And we worship you. We thank you for everything. And it's just so much. It's such a long list. We ask your forgiveness for our shortcomings and our pitfalls. We ask for the ability to turn to you and to throw away idols and focus our attention on you. We ask for the strength to be with you all the days of our lives, and for you to be with us, protect us, bless us, and show us your way. Keep our feet on your path. We're so grateful for everything you've done, and we just ask for more of you in our lives, with our families, our businesses, with our hearts and our health and our finances and our minds, with the world around us raging. We just ask for your peace and your grace and blessing and protection, your daily bread every day. We ask for more of you, and thank you, thank you, thank you. Forgive us when we misstep, and keep our feet on your path. We love you so much, and we pray these things in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen.